We're talking to Mrs. Warren Cuddy, Lucy Cuddy, who came to Valdez, was it 1915? 1916, as a school teacher. And she knew my mother and father, Anthony and Dorothea Diamond, from that time on. And she remembers my mother and father from a point of view of a neighbor and has some things to tell us about our life in Valdez. Now, Lucy, could you tell us about, you were saying that my dad was usually the leader of anything that went on in town?
Well, it seemed to me Tony was always the mayor. He wasn't all of the time, but he was the mayor a great deal of the time. One of the things that just dawns on me right now, we all had cesspools for there was no water sewage in town. But a lot of people turned their sewer into the creek, the little creeks around town. And the council decided that they would quit doing that, and you must have a cesspool for your dishwasher as well as for your toilets, which we'd had. And within the week, Tony was putting in a cesspool and had men there digging trenches for it. And I said, "What on earth is Tony doing?" We didn't have a daily paper. I didn't know they'd done that. She said, "Oh, the council has decided that we'll no longer use the creeks." And Tony was the first person to get his in. And I didn't know of any other person that ever turned their sewer into the creek. They may have, and they'll rise up and tell you about it. But that's the only person I ever knew that did it. And, of course, they had waterworks later. But
I mean, he was the only one who dug a cesspool.
Everybody had a cesspool, yes. More or less. Everybody uh-huh. who had an electric pump had a cesspool for their water. Mm-hmm. But they decided not to let any of the sewer run into the creeks anymore. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, I never saw another person. We had one in our house mm-hmm. and for the toilet. But this was to take the dishwasher and everything. Dishwasher, your toilet facilities went into a special cesspool. Mm-hmm. And then your wastewater and all, you had another one
for
it.
And so he was digging a separate one for the dishwater.
That's right.
And he was the only one you ever knew that did that.
That was my understanding, mm-hmm. that they didn't have a cesspool. They may not have had a cesspool for the toilet. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that was the way your father always responded to the rules of the town.
He was very law-abiding, wasn't he?
Extremely so.
Yes. I remember that if he bought a ticket to a ball game and he paid, say, $2 for the ticket, and after the game was half over, there was a $5 seat empty, he would never move down to the $5 seat the way everybody else would. He felt it was dishonest because he'd only paid
$2. I didn't know
so that. He was extremely scrupulous about things like that.
Tony had a great sense of humor, too. I mean, I don't think there were over 1,000 people in Valdez. And some man came through giving a course in memory, cultivating and developing the memory. And Tony took it, and so one night, Warren and I were walking along the street. He was cutting the yard, and we were talking, and Warren said, "Say, Tony, I didn't sign up for that course. Is it any good?" He said, "Oh, my goodness, this is the night to meet, and it's all over but now." And
he was taking
the memory course, but he'd forgotten to go with the lesson.
Oh.
And I think one of the first times I knew Tony, you see, your mother lived 4 or 5 blocks from her mother, and the house that they lived in when I began knowing the Diamonds was, and that seems funny in a little town, but as a neighbor, when Dorothy, your mother, moved outside, Dorothy's mother moved outside, Dorothy, the Diamonds, moved into Mrs. Miller's home, and that's where I...
That's when I really became acquainted with
them, because I hadn't known them only as the Diamonds before, and we'd go to parties and all, but I mean intimately. And we had a little boat. It was about the size of a lifeboat, and it had a very strong engine. We were always taking trips in it. So the first time the Diamonds went with us, we always took ham and eggs as a rule and made coffee. And my husband was, I felt just perfectly marvelous to help. He always built the fire and got the water, and then he smoked his pipe while I fried the ham and looked after the coffee. So the first time we took the Diamond family, Tony got to work and made the fire, and he didn't make a fire like Warren did. He got two long logs of wood, like two trees, and put them about a foot apart. Then in between, he filled it with brush and made a low fire and let it burn down. Then he sat himself down on one of the logs. Of course, your father was lame, and he could put his that stiff leg out. And he sat down, but he'd already had his water and his skillet and everything together. And of course, I was getting ready to fry the ham. He said, "Oh, get me the skillet." And I just stood with my mouth open. He fried the ham, and he fried the eggs, and he made the coffee. And then when we got through, he said, he washed up the dishes. And I said to Dorothy, "Is he just showing out?" She said, "No, he always does that. That's a result of his prospecting days. He leaves everything clean." It was a great pleasure to take your father on a trip, because I didn't fry the ham anymore.
Uh-huh. Well, I remember on the picnics we used to have together near Bridalveil Falls, seems to me he used to help clean up. Clean up after the picnics were over.
Well, that was his as a result of prospecting, your mother said. And your mother and I had lots of picnics because Warren was district attorney at that time, and your father a lawyer, and they were going to court a lot. While Valdez was a center, it was court headquarters at that time for the 3rd Division. Courts were up. Most of the business was over in Anchorage, and they were really gone a lot. So
yes, I remember my dad was gone a great deal.
He was gone a great deal. Then, of course, he was in politics, which took him away quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But we, your mother and I, we had lots of picnics, and I think one of the nicest picnics we ever had, it was when two of the new teachers had come, and this just happened. It was a beautiful day in September, you know, those when the sun comes out and it's warm. And she came by and said, "Let's have a picnic, and we'll go to school and get the kids." So we went down.
This was after school.
School
was
had
old.
Started. Uh-huh. No, school had started. No, it was early in September. Yeah. Mm-hmm. School was on in the morning. So we went down and got to Wendy's and bread, and I mean buns.
Did you take the kids out of school?
Oh, no. Oh. I'm just going to tell you about the kind of picnics we had. No, so at noon, we showed up at school and got her kids ours, and we asked the two new teachers to come go with us. And we went out across the dike. And it was a picnic just getting away. I mean, you could have a picnic just practically two lots from home and you'd be in the wilderness. We went across the dike on the beach there and made a fire. And, of course, the teachers just couldn't get over and have a picnic and then go back to school and go to work.
Oh, I see. It was a picnic just for their lunch
just
hour.
It was a lunch. You had it for the lunch hour. Mm-hmm. And then you could do it all very well within an hour or two, mm-hmm. because everything was close together. Right across the dike wasn't over five blocks from school. Then another picnic that your mother and I had, one of the teachers is Mrs. Brown's, Miss Norman Brown's mother and sister had come up to visit us and to visit them. And so one beautiful morning, your mother was great on picnics, and she said, "Let's have a picnic and take Blanche's mother and sister." So we did, and I guess I had a leg of lamb left from Sunday. And anyhow, the thing that most impressed the guests, we drove to Bridalveil. You children were all in school, and Mrs. Brown was on the jury. So the four of us drove to Bridalveil, and the thing they never got over, they didn't tell me, but Mrs. Brown told me, was your mother took a long cream and an egg whip and whipped up the cream to put in the fruit salad that we had. And you could have fruit salad on a picnic with whipped cream.
Oh, my.
In those days, it was a great time when everything was done with whipped cream. Of course, it was before the era of diet, you know.
Yes.
Nobody ever considered diet. Of course, your mother never put a pound on either. I turned off a little bit. Let's see if anything's
fun.
Even your father, as I said, seemed to be mayor all the time, but he wasn't, naturally. And I remember when President Harding came, the mayor wanted him to ride with President Harding out to Bridalveil Falls. That was where we always took everyone. Of course, that was the era of Model T Fords.
That was in 1921 or 22.
22 or 3, 22. I've forgotten which.
22.
Uh-huh. And the road, of course, was just a one-way graveled road and narrow, and it was the hills were terrifically steep. But the mayor of the town wanted Tony to ride, out to Bridalville, and that was a scenic trip that they were to give the people, the president. So there were a lot of interesting things about when the president came. They were fun to us because it was the things that happened behind the scene. The one that you, Anne, were in Cordova, because the night before you'd broken your collarbone riding your little wooden tricycle, and your mother taking you down to Cordova. We didn't have a doctor in Valdez to have it set or looked after or taped, whatever they did then. So when she got back from Cordova, I said to her, I was telling her about some of the different things that happened that were funny, and she said, well, Tony said, really, the president was a great scout, so we drove out and said he got out of his plug of tobacco and began to chewing tobacco, so we just had a nice trip all the way out and back. And then she says, now, Lucy, I don't know whether Tony just made that up or whether the president really did chew tobacco. So I've often wondered myself if people who really knew.
Well,
I didn't ever ask Tony if
the president really chewed tobacco. Well, my mother, or maybe it was my father, told me that he did chew tobacco before he was married, and that my mother made him quit. Did you ever hear that story?
No, you mean that Tony did?
I
wouldn't be all surprised.
I imagine most of the prospectors did. They couldn't bother with cigarettes or couldn't afford
cigarettes
it.
Cigarettes were called coffin nails before the World War I. It was just a crime to smoke a cigarette because it was supposed to be habit forming, and the paper in which the tobacco was rolled was supposed to be treated with some sort of an opiate that made it habit forming, and they called it, all the churches called it coffin nails.
And of course now they're calling them that again because of the cancer.
Yes, that's true. It's a kind of a rotation.
But
when War One started, they just quit calling them coffin nails. They wanted the boys to have anything they wanted. They'd be sending cigarettes right and left to the boys overseas, and by the time they got back, we had the jazz age, and the women began smoking too.
Yes. Did President Harding come to Valdez for any particular purpose?
Long story about President Harding. Yes, President Harding was not his. He came on his own ship, the Henderson, and he came up here to drive the Golden Spike when they connected the railroad
from
officially.
Seward
to Fairbanks.
To Fairbanks. Mm-hmm.
So the ship anchored over at Seward, and the party went to Fairbanks, and then they stayed in Seward, and they were here quite a bit, and they weren't supposed to come into Valdez, and as a last minute gesture, they came into Valdez, and were there. Well, they were supposed to be there at 11 in the morning, and they got in about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And I think this might be interesting. As I told you, a Model T was about the only thing that could travel that Richardson Highway because it was high, it sat high. But for the president, we borrowed a car from Fairbanks. I don't know what kind it was, but it was a gear shift. And we borrowed that for him to ride in, but everybody else was in the Model T Ford.
Okay.
Really had a lot of fun in this boat. I'm backing up again to the boat. And one time we went out on one of those beautiful summer afternoons, and we got over toward Hubbardsville and toward Mineral Creek. And just your father was steering the boat, and Warren was in the back taking care of the engine. And there was a long point of land that ran out into the water, and unless you knew it were there, you were likely to be grounded. Unless it was high tide. And Warren said, say, Tony, I think you better watch here. We're approaching that point that unless the tide's high, we can hit it. Just at that time, zip, we hit the point and grounded.
It was hidden just beneath the water.
It was hidden just between the water. Mm-hmm. So I'll never forget, Tony he understood the country better than I did. And as long as my husband didn't seem scared, I wasn't either. He said, that's all right, Tony. I said, I'll just get out. I've got hip boots and I'll push it off. And your father had great concern written on his face at the danger, but I didn't feel it was dangerous because Warren didn't seem scared. So he got onto the land out in his hip boots from the back and waded out to the stern, and then he pushed the boat, and as it left the land, he jumped aboard. So later I asked your father, I said, you seemed really worried about that. He said, Lucy, that was very dangerous. And if he'd have missed that at all with those hip boots on, he could have sunk and drowned. And so he was really aware of all the dangers of the country. a great deal.
Were the tides, or are the tides in Valdez as high as they are here in Cook Inlet?
No.
They're not as high, but I guess they're treacherous.
Well, tides are always, I mean, when you're going to hit, if land is exposed at low tide, mm-hmm. and then you can't see it when it's covered, why, unless you know the waters, which Warren did know, we'd gone out there quite often. And your father didn't really care much for cards, but during the long winter, sometimes the four of us played bridge. And one thing he said was, I was telling you some remark, and I said, I wonder if we get narrow-minded up here, that we are so insular that we really don't understand. And your father had the remark, he said, oh, Lucy said, we are just absolutely enclosed, and said, we're bound to be. He put it much better than this, but we're bound to have very close opinions that will have to be broadened. And, of course, they have broadened throughout the years.
Yes, well, in those days, the boats took, what, around 10 days to come?
No, seven.
Seven.
You'd leave Seattle, and it depended on how much freight they had coming up, how long they stayed in each port, and they stopped at all the ports in southeastern Alaska, and then Cordova, and then Valdez.
Yes. And so your outside newspapers were quite old when they arrived
there. That's right.
There.
That's right. Of course, it was before radio. And
yes, I remember radio in the 20s when I was a young child, but I guess in
it
the
was
teens
just coming
there,
in. Oh, no.
There wasn't any at all.
No.
So you really were isolated.
That's right. And while we had a newspaper some of the time, many times, especially after World War I, sometimes we didn't have a newspaper.
The Valdez Miner, you mean the
That's
local
right.
newspaper?
That's right, the local newspaper. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was no radio to bring other news in. You weren't so in such close contact with what went on. And naturally, you didn't take as much interest in national affairs because it wasn't brought so close to you.
Yes.
Now, well, while we were so far away from everything, we kept up with the styles and were interested in what went on. And I remember one time when your father had been down to the legislature, and that year he'd taken a house, and all of you had been down there. And before Dorothy left, she had two of the prettiest evening dresses. At that time, Lord and Taylor put out catalogs, and so did Altman of clothes. And so Dorothy got these two lovely dresses from Lord and Taylor, and they'd come before she'd gone down to Juneau. And one especially was a shell pink georgette, heavily beaded. And your mother had lovely hair. In later life, you probably remember her hair being very dark, but she had lovely light brown hair. And of course, it had nice texture, and it was naturally wavy, so she didn't have to spend much time making herself look good. But when you got back from the legislature, Viola Sullivan, Harve Sullivan, was marshal, and so his wife Viola decided to have a dinner party, which we had lots of dinner parties, but this was small, and I think there were five couples, and so, and she always served things so nice, and she is a wonderful cook, and she usually had somebody to come in and help her, so it was quite an occasion when Viola had a party, because she wasn't jumping up and down from the table as much as Dorothy and I would be if we'd been having a dinner. So Dorothy came by my house in the afternoon before, and she said, Lucy, let's dress up for the dinner. And as I say, I don't remember what we wore to dinner parties, but she meant get on the most formal thing we had. And I happened to have a flowered chiffon from the year before. It was beaded, but it wasn't new. And of course, she had this beautiful new pink, shell pink dress. I said, okay, let's do it, and we'll tell whoever the other visiting woman would have been.
And this was out without telling the hostess.
No, we didn't tell the hostess at all. And so she said, you suppose the men will wear their tux? And Tony had a new tux that he'd had for the legislature. And she said, do you suppose Warren will wear his tux? And I said, ye gods, I'll bet he won't, but you can ask him. I'd never seen him have it on. He'd had it before he's married. And so we went down to the office and told him what we were going to do. And Dorothy says, Tony, Warren, will you wear your tux? He says, sure. So the men wore the tuxes. When we arrived, we all went together so we wouldn't appear so highly dressed to our hostess. And so we went in. Harve came to the door, and he, instead of saying hello, he yelled, Viola, come here, Viola. She came out. In those days, you had beautiful house dresses, and they were starched. And she had, I remember just as well, it was a very pretty kind of a beige background with blue and lavender flowers in the house dress she had on. Now you just call them cottons. But so he said, I'm not coming to the party, Viola. She says, go upstairs and get your tux. Says, you've got a clean shirt, so-and-so. So he went and put his on, and then before dinner she found something, and we all sat down and dined in great style. And your mother started that idea of putting on the best you had when you went to dinner.
I remember when I was a little girl, the one party that was at our house, when all you ladies came dressed in these lounging pajamas that were so popular in the 20s. They were made of silk or something.
Well, that's when rayon first came in.
Rayon.
It looked like silk, but it was not.
And all of you came in pajamas, and I think, I'm not sure if it was you or someone else, Mrs. Clifton perhaps, who came in her husband's pajamas.
No, it was I, because I slept in nightgowns and I didn't have one.
Didn't
I wore
have
my husband's
one of those lounging pajamas.
And Warren's pajamas were not really flattering to me either, so that I never did like dress-up parties, but your mother just adored them. She did.
Yeah, I remember.
One thing about your mother, there were very few people who went to the trouble of having gardens in Valdez, and I think one reason could have been that the soil was glacier soil, more or less, that sandy soil. But
it's hard to grow things.
That's right, without a lot of fertilizer and soil. But she would come back from Juneau each spring. The legislature just met every 2 years, but she always brought back calendula plants, all kinds of plants. And except for Mrs. Donahoe, who had moved away, Mr. Donahoe had been your father's partner, and she'd moved to Cordova, but except for Mrs. Donahoe, at that time no one ever had a garden except your mother. And she, I remember in the corner of your front yard there is where she put the calendulas. And knowing more about gardens now, I don't know how they even grew, because that was a very low spot.
Mm-hmm.
And but she always had plants in the house and flower beds. And then, but her plants, I don't like house plants myself. But one time, Judge Love brought me a fern from Seattle. It was a beautiful fern. And I really did try to take care of it. And I showed it to Dorothy one day when she was down, and I said, now, what do you suppose has happened to that? She said, you don't like them. I said, but I've tried with this, and really I have. She said, a plant knows when you don't like it, and she said, that's why it doesn't do well. So that was her philosophy. The fern did die, too.
Well, and she certainly had a green thumb. And
well, I really felt once that I held my own with your mother, though. I think I don't know anyone in Alaska that ever knew as much about it or enjoyed it as much as your mother did. She knew where the violets grew. They were about 6 miles from town. See where the violets were.
We're talking about violets.
Yes. Your mother knew where the violets were, and they were 6 miles from town out in a marshy part of, on the left-hand side of the road, out on the Richardson, which is now called the Richardson Highway. You drove out there, and these violets were 6 and 8 inches long in stems, and we just get huge bouquets of violets. And also she knew where the best places were to pick currants, and I loathe picking currants, but every year to celebrate our birthdays, hers was on the 3rd of August and mine was on the 2nd, and neither of our husbands remembered our birthdays very well. And but if Tony remembered, he'd warn Warren, or Warren would tell Tony, but Tony usually had to remind. I suppose Marie was big enough to prompt him. But we got to where on August 2nd, we would go to out behind old Camp Comfort, which was an abandoned roadhouse, and get currants. And she could pick more currants than anybody ever saw in my life. Out of they had fallen logs and rotten, boggy places where the currants grew. And she'd fill her pan in just no time, and I would pick carefully and come out where she'd have a gallon. I might have 2 quarts. But Warren kept up with her fairly well, and she thought Warren liked to pick berries, but she knew I just loathed picking berries. And I remember, the year before we moved over here, we were coming over here, and she came over and says, Warren, let's go currant picking. Lucy just won't go. And she said, he didn't like to pick berries, but he didn't like to tell her. He said, Dorothy, I don't think it would look well for you and me to go pick currants. So he kidded her, and we wound up going. And so we'd go and pick berries, and then we'd drive on to Tikal when we filled our pans and have dinner at I knew somebody who ran the roadhouse. We'd have a chicken dinner there and then come back. So we'd go leave on my birthday and get back on her.
Oh, we'd make an overnight trip.
No, we didn't stay all night. It was only Well, I don't know, TKL. Maybe it's
But you mean you'd go and it would be light all night anyway.
Well, that's right. In June or September, not necessarily. But we'd drive back and eat dinner on the way somewhere, coming back. But we got in both days. But your mother knew, I had so much respect for her because she knew where all the berries were and where the best wildflowers were. And she was the first person I ever saw who forced flowers. One time in her dining room, she had, what is the berry they had? Salmonberry. She'd picked the salmonberries before the leaves had come out of the blossoms and shed them on her dining room table, and they had forced them.
Yes.
And that's the first time I'd ever seen anyone force berry.
And now that's quite common.
Oh, very common. But in those days where we didn't have any flowers or anything chipped up at all, no begonias, for instance, why it was something to have a blooming flower.
Yes, and through the long winters, I imagine the houses would seem kind of bare without, to some people who liked flowers.
Well, we just didn't have them, so that was that. But I always felt that, I really felt that I had arrived, though, when your mother and father moved here after he'd been delegate and he came to be judge in Anchorage. your mother didn't drive, and so she and I went out one day with Fritz to get some trees to plant. And already previously she'd said, "Lucy, now where do you get violets?" I said, "Dorothy, you just don't get violets unless you drive up to Independence Mine up that way." "Oh," she said, "there are bound to be violets around town." I said, "Well, if you can find them, I'd like to see them." And I thought, darn it, she'll be sure to find them because she'll know. So on this trip when we went out to get trees, she loved to go out in the woods, so she went with us. And we got out along Sand Lake, somewhere over in there, and she said, "Now, Lucy, I'm sure there are violets over," and she pointed to the left. I said, "I don't think you'll find violets." She said, "They should be there." I said, "Well, we won't leave you. Go on and see if you can find them." And she came back, and she looked really nonplussed. She said, "Well, there should be violets in that kind of land, but they're not there. And I don't know why they're not violets around here."
I have never seen wild violets around here.
Close in. The only time I've ever seen them has been up on the mountain.
And yet I remember near Valdez there were violets. So it must have something to do with the rainfall.
I haven't the slightest idea why, but it's true. But Tony was gone a lot, and Dorothy loved to drive, but she didn't like to go alone with your children. So we went in our car, and she was in hers with you three children. And I know we drove up on the summit, and I had never seen so many wildflowers that time. Your mother really got me interested in wildflowers. Well, of course, I came direct to the university here, and I had never fooled with that sort of thing. We just had them where I was brought up. So we got to work, see how many different varieties of wildflowers we could get. And I said, "Well, why don't we have a rock garden?" And so we brought home all sorts of varieties of mosses and things that were in bloom to make a rock garden. Now, I don't remember anything about her rock garden or what became of it or where she put it. But we lived down in the Oliver Murroy house then, and Warren got quite interested in it. We got some rocks and in one corner of my yard, got the rocks and filled them up with dirt and planted all of these wildflowers I brought back. They were a rock garden type being coming from the summit. This has nothing to do with your mother and father, but I think it's interesting. So I got them all planted and worked hard with them and watered. And so Warren and I took a ride every night after supper. So one night, the second night we came back, and my rock garden, the flowers are still there, but somebody had stuck it full of skunk cabbage. And so, well, we both just roared. I mean, we had Anchorage, Valdez was small, and you got your entertainment from each other. And so we began to laugh and laugh. It hadn't hurt the garden, but somebody had just stuck it full of skunk cabbage. The skunk cabbage really is pretty when it first comes out. That's right, and it doesn't seem to smell so bad. But anyhow, then across the street out came Tom Huddleston. He was head of the road commission based there. He and his wife and one of the drivers came out. And Tom had done it. He'd seen how hard I'd worked at this rock garden. So he just added some, and he said, "I was going to watch it if you were mad. I wasn't going to come out, but if you weren't, I was going to come." So that was just a little aftermath of a rock garden. Yeah. I've spoken about your father being mayor, which of course he wasn't all the time, but when he was in town, if anything public, any public meetings were there, your father usually was, spoke. And the, one of the things I remember about him, I knew him so well, that I wasn't aware of his lameness. It was just a part of Tony. And I remember one time, it was at a bond rally for selling bonds, and your father made the speech at the time, this is War One again, and saying, I remember him saying, well, this, he didn't call his leg a game leg, I forgot, this stick of mine, what can I do for a war except buy a bond? I think he spoke of his leg as a stick. And so it was very impressive, and he always was known as a person of great patriotism, and
yes,
and also one of the backbones of Alaska as a great citizen. And at the time, if you remember, I forgot, I think he was, as we call it, politicking. I think it was when he was running for senator.
But in the legislature?
Yes, here in town.
Local legislature.
I mean, this is before he went to, maybe he was running for, maybe he was running for delegate. Yes, that was what it
when
was.
When he hurt his shoulder?
Yes, that was delegate.
He was running for delegate for the first time.
That's right, mm-hmm. That's right. I wonder what he's doing up Fairbanks Way.
Yeah.
But in the flying has just beginning, and Tony was never, he always accepted everything that came modern. And he was flying and up in Fairbanks, as like on the boat. At this accident we had, which wasn't an accident, fortunately, but Tony was always very helpful, and this was one of the little planes, which was what we had up here, and up in Fairbanks, up near Fairbanks, when the plane landed, it was a float plane, he got off to help the...
Well, moor the plane, I suppose.
Yes, help the pilot moor the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought the engine had died, and just as he stepped up on the float, there's one more gasp of the engine, and it hit him in the shoulder. And
the propeller. Right,
yes, and why it didn't kill him, it just hit him there instead of in the head. So I always told Dorothy that he never would, he had a charmed life, because I don't know too much about his accident that made him lame, but of course you know that. I mean, I know it was a gun accident.
Yes, it was almost a miracle that he didn't have a gangrene infection from that, because it was two or three days before he saw a doctor.
I know it was, and he was in the hospital a long time. That was on a horseback, and it was his own gun, wasn't it?
Yes, his own gun went off and shot him in the leg. And Mrs. Hoffman told me that her husband, Marshall Frank mm-hmm. Hoffman, helped get him out,
mm-hmm.
and they had to build a boat to float him down the river to Cordova
mm-hmm.
to Dr. Council.
I know, it was a miracle
that he did, in those days with no antibiotics.
Yes.
You know, if a man had a bad wound, he often died of gangrene.
Absolutely, and we didn't have, in addition to antibiotics, you didn't have all the...
sanitary conditions.
Well,
either.
Like mercurochrome and
yeah.
all that sort of thing that we have now, immediately kits for taking
yeah.
care of this. Well, I remember, I told, following this, of course, Dorothy went up to Fairbanks, she was in the hospital, I don't remember how long, it was quite a... injured his shoulder, but it had missed his head in just a very short...
I think it broke his shoulder bone, on top of his shoulder, and his collarbone, too.
I had forgotten.
Because when he came back to Valdez, I remember he had his arm and his shoulder in a sling.
Did he? Uh-huh. You know, he stayed in the hospital. Dorothy went. She went by car, and that was quite something to go by car
to drive.
Fairbanks.
I think she went at night, too.
Well, she didn't drive, though. She went with Ed Lerdahl, and drove one of Andy Derringer's cars. And the cars were better than Model Ts then. It was a gear shift.
But the road was still pretty poor.
Still was a dirt road. Mm-hmm. And then Tony had another near accident. Oh, two or three near accidents. And Dorothy would be so sort of frustrated about it. Once he started down the dock, and he wasn't a very good driver. I don't think he especially liked to drive cars. But anyhow, he started down the dock in this big Studebaker you had. And you remember the approach to town from the Valdez dock was a long approach.
Long one.
And when he got down near to the dock, he hit the railing and just hung. The car didn't go off, it just hung there, and he got out of the car and had somebody else bring him back, and somebody said, what on earth happened? He said, well, I thought I saw a bear over on the mountain, and just when I glanced up to look, he went off of the rail. And then when your Uncle Herbert and his wife came up to
that
visit...
It was 31, wasn't it?
I don't know the day.
Mm-hmm.
We started on a picnic. We were going, I don't remember where we were going, taking a picnic for Sunday, and Bud was riding with my two boys, Warren and me, and you all were following with the two girls and your aunt and uncle, and Tony was driving. Well, we got on to Tickell, and we waited and waited, and you didn't come. So we decided you'd had some car accident. We just went ahead and had our dinner, and later on somebody came and said, well, no, they had a car accident, and they're not coming. Well, we didn't know what had happened, and it developed that when they reached the, you remember that bridge on Snow Slide? It was just like a raft with just heavy logs on each side. It was a temporary bridge that was taken out in the winter and put back in the summer. And when you stop there to take pictures or get a drink, I believe Marie wanted a drink. She was always wanting a drink. And when you stop there, everybody got out except Dorothy and your aunt. And the brake hadn't held, and the car began to slide, and it slid. And when it reached the, they thought they were going over. And Dorothy, it was that Studebaker that year had the emergency in the middle of the floor. You use it with your right hand. And your aunt was in the front, and she wasn't used to that kind of a brake, and she couldn't find the brake, and Dorothy was trying to reach across and pull it on, and all the time the car was sliding, and it slid off, and just as it reached the edge, it hit a bump and stopped. So I told her, and Tony had climbed up on the running board when they saw it begin to move to try to pull on the brake, and he couldn't reach it. And I said, Tony's life is charmed. He'll never die by accident, because that is just too... accidents that could be very serious.
Yes, I remember that incident. I remember my dad hung on to the bumper trying to stop the car. Of course, his weight wouldn't hold the car back. And my mother reached, she was in the back seat, and she reached up and grabbed the wheel and turned it. And
did she?
It turned and just caught.
Oh, I see. I thought she was trying to get the brake herself. But anyhow,
she finally did pull the wheel over. And I guess they were so shaken up, they couldn't go any further.
No, they turned and came home. That's right.
They went back home.
As I told her, I said, you don't believe in predestination. But I said, that is certainly, it's not Tony's time at all. I don't think there was a, is it on?
Yes.
I don't think there's a woman in town that cooked better than your mother. She honestly just forced me to learn to make bread, and it came out all right, because later on we didn't have a bakery, and I learned to make bread when this quick yeast came in. And I can make good bread, but she was the one that just absolutely forced me into it, and she made such good bread herself. But I remember one night, I don't think anybody in town had better food than you all did. And I knew that night what you'd had for dinner, because she told me she was making a leg of lamb, and she had the potatoes that were cooked in with the lamb and coleslaw, and I know a big apple pie. And your father went back to the office practically every night to study and read. He had a very good library, not only for his law, but for the reading, the new books that he bought to read, to keep us from being insular, in other words, which helps. Mm-hmm. And so... this night, Warren and I were great for taking a walk just before we went to bed. We'd walk down the dock, and we were coming back, and Warren said, my goodness, Tony's in there still at work. There's Tony in the restaurant. We walked up the street. I said, ye gods, I don't know how that man can eat. I said, I know what Dorothy cooked for supper night, and you know your father never put on a pound in his life. So the next day I said, Dorothy, you ought to divorce Tony. She says, what did he do? I said, after that good dinner you cooked last night, I saw him in at 11 o'clock eating at Fisher's. She said, well, it's just as well, because said he always eats before he goes to bed, and he'd come home fried ham and eggs if he hadn't eaten down there. So
I remember in from my early childhood that my dad was a tremendous eater, and as you say, he never gained weight.
No?
But when he was older, why, he didn't have the same appetite in his last 10 years or so. He was quite abstemious. But as a child, I remember how he loved butter.
Yes.
He used to just pile butter on
his mother bread. Made such good bread, no wonder.
Yes.
No, your father was, well, he consumed lots of energy, too, but he, and I don't remember that he was such a great eater, but I mean, just the fact that he ate before him. But in those earlier days, even in Valdez, everybody usually ate before they went to bed something. I mean, there was no, I don't remember how much weight I put on that first year I was married, because if you didn't go out and play bridge and eat at night, you fix something if you want to. And
yes.
Now you don't eat at all at night anymore.
Well, as you mentioned before, dieting has become so prominent in these days.
That's right.
And I don't remember anybody when going on a diet when I was a child.
Oh, no. No, there was. I think the first time we ever heard of diet was when Dr. Wise came, and that must have been along in 1930. And Viola Sullivan hadn't been well, and he put her on a diet, and it was a very strict diet. She was, and I remember some people from Fairbanks came in for just drove in, and the judge's wife had washed from Fairbanks, and she had said, let's get up a picnic for them. So we all fried chicken, and must have had 2 dozen people, we asked them, but to this picnic out at Bridal Veil, we took, fried chicken was the basis of the food and everything else in proportion. And Viola was standing there with a little can of crushed pineapple and a little can of, I think it was grapefruit. And Dr. Wise, who had put her on this strict diet, he saw her, and he really, I'm sure, felt ashamed of himself because he was a tremendous eater himself and a big man. And he said, oh, Mrs. Sullivan says you can eat some chicken. Said, don't just feel that you have to eat that. And boy, I never forget how she seems to enjoy that fried chicken.
Oh, yeah.
She was a tremendously good cook herself. Uh-huh. And, well, there was no reason for, I never have any sympathy for people who say they can't cook. You have to have the desire, and you can find anything in the book to go by. You may have to experiment a little while. But
that's right. I think that a good basic cookbook, like The Joy of Cooking, is a must.
That's
and
right.
And then if someone wants to cook well, just follow the recipe.
That's right. The hardest thing I had to do when I started housekeeping at Valdez was cook on a cold range, and I didn't know much about cooking anyhow, but a cold range was just death to me. And one day at a party, I said, they asked me how I was getting along with housekeeping. I said, I don't seem to work it right. I said, I either burn my food up or it doesn't cook. And Mrs. Cameron said, well, Mrs. Cuddy, the way with a cold range when you cook, said you keep your fire, you don't have it hot, but you keep it. And I remember she used a gesture of lifting her hand, says you just keep it coming all the time, and your oven will work. And I never had any trouble from then on.
Yes, I think it's amazing how you women could bake bread on those cold ranges without knowing what the temperature really was. And now we have these electric thermostats that just are so wonderful.
Yes.
I don't think I could cook on a coal range. I'd have to learn to cook all over again.
Yes, well, you would. You could.
Mm-hmm. Back in the early 20s, as I remember, you used to boil your clothes in a big copper kettle on the stove. Wasn't that still being done? I can seem to remember a copper kettle on my mother's coal range where she boiled the handkerchiefs.
Well, she probably did.
Mm-hmm.
Funny thing, I don't remember too much about having a boiler. But your mother had, coming back to the cooking, your mother had the first, I think about the first, except for Walter Stewart, who had the electric plant, she had the first electric stove in town.
Electric stove. Mm-hmm.
And she got one that had everything on it. It had even a warming oven up above.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was very progressive in getting everything that happened.
With the power so erratic, I can remember the power going off.
You had to keep your coal range also.
I imagine she kept that too, didn't she?
That was your auxiliary heat,
yes.
Cooking, because if the power went off, which so often did for days, you had to keep your coal range.
Yes, she had both.
I did too, later. I got an electric stove later, but not as early as she did.
Mm-hmm.
And the coal range was just a necessity. Mm-hmm. A cold range is awfully nice, though, in lots of ways. Of course, they're dirty.
Well, it did keep the kitchen warm.
That's right.
I can remember we had a coal stove in the living room and a coal range in the kitchen, and that was our heat.
That's right.
And our upstairs bedrooms had no heat.
Theoretically, the pipes had a little cold up, but it wasn't a little heat, but not
and
much.
And nowadays, everyone has to have heat in every room.
That's
and
right.
We children never thought we were being denied anything by sleeping in a cold bedroom.
Well, you didn't know any different.
Didn't know any different.
This cold range, though, coming back to that, there was something awfully cheerful about a cold range because you always put the tea kettle on, and when it boiled and simmered, the room was getting warm.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think one thing you do miss in the kitchen now and keeps it from, well, the kitchen's not supposed to be so chummy anymore. It's everything is efficiency. But that a tea kettle boiling, to me, was sort of a hospitable, sort of a comfortable feeling to have in
the
kitchen.
And also, this the warming oven, most of the coal ranges also had warming
ovens. They all had
ovens,
warming ovens.
And that was a perfect place for to put bread so it would rise.
That's right.
I can remember my mother's
loaves get too hot
of bread sitting up there.
Mm-hmm.
She
it wouldn't
was letting
get too
them rise.
Hot.
Yes, I can remember some delicious smells coming out of the kitchen.
Oh, she was a tremendous cook, and she loved to cook, too.
Yes.
I don't know whether you were here, but if you remember when your mother died, she loved to cook. I mean, cooking with your mother, it was like her garden. It was an art.
It was her art.
Uh-huh. And I remember when I went over after your mother died, in the kitchen were six great big loaves of bread. She cooked them because she wanted to.
Yes.
And she liked it.
And the day she died, she had baked a cake for a bake sale.
That's right.
And taken it downtown.
That's right.
And so she really was cooking right up to the last minute.
And she, lots of the easier things that we did, she wouldn't accept because she wasn't right sure about this, but you take currants, for instance. I had lots of currants and raspberries, and we didn't go out in the wilds to pick anymore, but she'd make her currant jelly over here. And she never used any of the artificial gels.
Like Certo?
No. And everybody talked about it. She said, well, she's a little embarrassed, I think, because everybody thought it was awful not to use it. She said, well, I don't know that I'm right, but my theory is that jelly is more like the fruit if you make it from scratch instead of putting this artificial Certo in. And so she made all of them by the old method. But I think, as I have said, it was an art whether she liked to cook, and she did it so well that there's nothing to be critical of her for that.
And she never used an electric mixer to mix up her cakes. She always beat them by hand.
Did she really? I didn't know that. Of course, I made so few cakes.
She didn't care for an electric mixer, and she... And of course, at the time she died, cake mixes were becoming very popular, and she would turn up her nose at a cake mix.
I'm sure she would.
She always made her cakes from scratch, and the thing that I couldn't understand was how she could cook without ever measuring anything. She didn't measure the flour or the sugar. She guessed at it, and her cakes were always just perfect.
Well, I remember when Bud was on a bottle, I nursed David till 9 months old because the book said that was better for him and poor kid, I think he didn't starve. And now she had Bud on a formula. Mm-hmm. And I said, now what do you do? Oh, she says, I just sort of guess that. I use my own ideas. I think then I've forgotten what the baby mix was that you bought to put in with the fresh milk. But she had her own ideas about that. And coming back to fresh milk for babies, all of the books, so there are only two books about babies. You had Holt's How to Raise, How to Feed and Care for a Baby. Dr. Holt, he was the Spock of today. Uh-huh. And then you had the government pamphlets, which corroborated what Holt said. And one day I just practically broke up a bridge party by saying, I think maybe it'd be much better to give children canned milk. Oh, everybody was just horrified. I said, well, the cows stay in the barn at least 6 months in the year. The snow is so deep. And they don't have grass. And this canned milk comes from cattle that have fed in the open and had all this sort of thing. And, of course, there weren't the balanced foods for animals then that there are now. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was probably an ignorant statement of mine. But I have been very interested to see it later. We bought all this fresh milk for our children, and we boiled it so it would kill the germs. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why the children live, because they were strong and healthy. But now they start the babies on canned milk.
That's right.
Starting with, you see. And so I probably wasn't as ignorant as...
No, you were ahead of your time.
I probably was, if I'd had the courage of my convictions, which I didn't.
You wanted to tell about my dad and the safety pins? We don't have this down.
Didn't I tell that?
No, not on tape.
Oh, didn't I?
No.
Oh, well, Tony, to have been a prospector... As I say, this cleaning up of the camp and all was neatness, but he was very neat and careful in his own person and with your children. And Dorothy, while she, as I say, cooking was an art with her, and her gardening and her flowers and all that same sort of thing, that was her artistry. But she knew nothing about sewing and had no interest in sewing. I suppose she had a needle and thimble somewhere. I don't think she knew how to use a thimble. But anyhow, your children all wore then what we call coveralls, and well, they're like coveralls of day, only the children, that's exactly what they wore. And it was a good thing for Valdez, because we had so much wind and the
play, dust and dirt.
Yes, and where you went out to play, it was rough, and mm-hmm. so it protected your legs. But the first coveralls were made with what you they were buttoned up, the seats were buttoned with what they called a bachelor button. It was a bratted button, it was bratted on, and then it snapped to a brad on the other side. And so, of course, when you put those things through the wringer, that was before your washing machines had the dryers or the whirl dry, you'd put them through a wringer. And those wringers were just death on buttons. And when they'd take a button off of one of these coveralls, well, it was just gone. So you'd put your coveralls on and there was no buttons. But Tony embarrassed him to see you around with a button off here and there in your pants. So he carried in his pocket safety pins. So if you came downtown, of course, the town was so small, you only lived 3 blocks from your father's office. He'd pick you up and pin up the pants where the buttons were off with safety pins. So that was one of the things he carried in his pockets instead of cigarettes. Your father, if you could get him started, he didn't have an awful lot of time to tell yarns, and he never talked a lot about his prospecting days, but he belonged to the era of when, you see, when I moved to Valdez, the road from Valdez to Fairbanks was called the Valdez-Fairbanks Trail, and that was a good name for it because it was just a one-way road that cars could travel, and if you saw another car coming, whichever of you had the better place pulled out and let the other pass. As a rule, you stopped and visited with each other and wanted to know how the road was on beyond. But as a trail, it was first just a packer's trail. And then later on, it became for wagons or in the winter for dog teams. And of course, there had to be places to sleep and rest along the road. And about every 10 miles, there were roadhouses. I think the only roadhouse that belongs to the earlier era that's left on what is now called the Richardson Highway is Sourdough. The rest have all been redone or burned down or whatnot, but Sourdough is an original one. But the roadhouses were all a place to stop for rest and to go on. And you'd make about 20 miles a day.
And even by car, automobile.
No,
this was before the automobile with the horses.
Horses, yes. Mm-hmm. This was back in the days with the mm-hmm. horses or the dogs, whichever you had, horses in the summer. But they theoretically made 20 miles a day. So every 7 or 10 miles along the highway, this trail, there was a log house to stop and rest. So one morning, your father told me this story, and I thought it was one of the best stories, and I've told it so many times. He didn't think it was so funny, but I think it's a terrific story. He was telling about one morning, the men who were going into Prospect or into the gold fields, they'd meet in the morning, they'd all have their breakfast down at the restaurant, and start out together in more or less of a train. And he told this morning especially of an Englishman that was going with him. He was young and he'd just arrived in Alaska, and he was listening and very quiet, but he had his own sled all well equipped with dogs. So they all had breakfast together, and then they drove, and by the time they reached Camp Comfort, which was 7 miles I think from Valdez, they had lunch there, and then drove on after an hour, and they reached Workman's, which was I think about 19 miles from Valdez, and there they stopped for the night. And Workman's was all the roadhouses were downstairs, was a kind of a lobby, which was a crude place with an oil drum made for the stove to heat the place, these big old 50 or 75 or 100 gallon drums. I'm digressing a little bit from my story, but this is interesting. But above the stove would be a rack on which you could hang your socks or anything that was wet to dry overnight. So this night, and then up above, you went up a crude steps to just a big dormitory room of bunks with very thin, poor mattresses, and the blankets were old army blankets, or they used a lot of coverlets or covers that were made of stuff with cotton, and you
like quilts. Sort
yes,
of.
But, well, they were mm-hmm. cotton comforters. Mm-hmm. Like a down comforter is now, only was cotton. Mm-hmm. And you never would have seen one, but as they get old, they were cheaply made, and the cotton just became hard.
Lumpy
stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, there was no such thing as sheets or anything of that sort. It was just a place to sleep and rest. So they stopped at Workman's, the same group of men did, that started out together in the morning, and they had their supper. And then it became time to go to bed, and by that time the little Englishman was beginning to feel quite a man of the country. And if he'd had a good time listening to the yarns that the men had told, and So when they all began to go upstairs to, for the night, he went to the man who had the roadhouse, Pete Cashman, and he said, I have enjoyed your hospitality so much. It's been such a pleasant evening. I've enjoyed the men and being with them and your hospitality. And he said, I really would like to spend the night. But he said, you know, I brought along my own little tent and my own sheets and bedroll because I have heard that some of these roadhouses have vermin. And he looked questioningly at Pete Cashman, and the hostler, the man who owned it, and he said, well, I'll tell you how it is. Says some brings them and some takes them away. And just how I'm fixed tonight, I can't say. But, so I always thought that was a good story.
Yes, I remember my dad and, telling that.
And your father said that the roadhouses did have vermin. They couldn't help it. That people came that were dirty, and they slept in the beds, and they left. And
they probably didn't change their clothes very often.
No,
either.
And they left the bed bugs there. And he said, I said, well, wasn't it awful? He said, no, so the way you do, before you got in bed, you'd take the blankets off and just shake and shake them and hope you shook everything out and that they wouldn't get back into the bed before morning. And that was their prevention for in order to have a good night's sleep.
Well, knowing how clean my father was, it must have been a trial to him if he did ever get bed bugs or lice on him.
Well, that must have been one of the reasons. I mean, he was so young when really he was only about 19, wasn't he, when he first came up here?
I think so, 19 or 20.
Uh-huh. And even if he may have been careless, he appreciated later on having things immaculate and in good shape.
Yes.
That could be true, too. Yeah, tell about that, too.
Yeah, well, you mentioned it, too. Well, you were going to tell about when my father first came to Valdez. He was considerably older than my mother, 10 years, and so she was still a child.
Yes.
And didn't she used to
run she told me she was the biggest. She and Mary Whalen, who was Mary Nielsen, were the greatest pests. Only I think it was a game with both of them. I don't know. Tony was driving. I don't know whether it was a delivery hack or a delivery sled or a coal sled or what it was. But he was doing some driving there in town with horses. And, of course, he'd have a whip with it. And she and Mary Whalen would grab onto the back and take a ride just hanging on to that. And the game was he'd crack the whip at them and pretend he's going to hit them. And that was her introduction to Tony. Mm-hmm. And she said they were just one whale of a pest to him. Mm-hmm. And the more I think of it, no, Tony, I think it was a fun game with both of them.
Yes, and quite then, like I think it was after that that he went prospecting and didn't come to Valdez as often, did he? Perhaps just
I don't know.
But at any rate, when he finally did come back for good, why, my mother had grown up.
That's right.
He looked at her with different eyes.
That's right. Did your father come to Valdez first? I didn't know that.
Yes. I understand that he came there in 1906, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And with Joe Murray, a friend of his from New York State had written him a letter and asked him to come up and go prospecting with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was his first partner in the...
Well, you see, when I knew Joe Murray, he lived in Cordova, and for some reason, mm-hmm. and the fact your father had been in the hospital in Cordova, I just sort of had the notion he went to Cordova first.
No, as I recall, it was Valdez, and Joe Murray was the one who talked him into coming,
I knew that. That's
coming
right.
to Alaska. According to this book, A Diamond of Alaska, my dad taught school, back east, but I don't remember hearing him say he did. Do you ever remember
No.
He taught school? When you came to, when you got to know my parents, were they already married?
Oh,
1916,
yes. Oh,
they were
Marie
married.
Was born. I was teaching in Valdez, and your Aunt Margaret one morning came to school and said she had a little niece, and that was Marie.
Oh.
And mm-hmm. I didn't know your mother then. And
how many years did you teach?
Oh, I just taught one. I managed to struggle through, and then I was married that summer.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what had Warren come up to do to Alaska?
To run the Valley's Mercantile.
Oh, he ran a store there.
He had already had the, he'd been admitted in the law, but he hadn't practiced.
He hadn't practiced. Yeah. And then when did he decide to start practicing?
Well, he was clerk of court when the Republicans came in and became
Harding's
district attorney.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. Harding
see.
Was the president that came to Alaska. We've had a lot of
yes.
presidents come to Alaska.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Roosevelt was here. I think he was down in the Aleutians,
yes.
however.
I
of
think
course.
He was in the Juneau area. And then Kennedy came before he was president.
That's right.
And then he came after, No, before his election.
He made a speech, you remember, out here. And then I don't know, seems to be Truman came as far as Juneau. I can't remember
that.
Yes,
but Johnson hasn't been there.
And of course, Mr. Hoover was Secretary of Commerce, and he was on the boat with Harding.
Oh, he came up with Harding.
Harding, uh-huh.
Yes. Uh-huh.